Duology Theater was made possible by producer Nolan Matten. Thank you, Nolan. It was also made possible by contributions from listeners like you.
The soundtrack to this movie is ridiculous.
It is. This is one of my notes, actually. I guess we're in it.
We're in it. Oh, we've been in it.
The soundtrack has a surprisingly, it's all synth, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah.
But
it's just John Carpenter sitting at a keyboard.
Yeah, but in terms of what it's recreating, this soundtrack has a surprising amount of woodblock and steel drums. I didn't notice that before. Hey everybody, welcome to Duology Theater.
Hello everyone, welcome back.
Welcome
to
back.
Duology Theater.
Yeah, welcome to April. This is April's Duology Theater, where we are covering Escape from New York and then Escape from LA. Yeah, I'm one of the hosts, David Bell.
I'm a second number of the hosts, Tom Ryman.
Tom.
Yeah it's me. It's me.
Yeah, Escape from New York.
Escape from New York. It's a all-time classic schlock. I guess action film.
Yeah.
By John Carpenter. It's, 1981?
Is this his second film? Is this his third?
It was his follow-up. I think it was his follow-up to Halloween.
Yeah, Halloween was his first, Escape, and then The Thing is after this?
Yes.
Or is it The Fog?
I think The Thing is after this.
Okay. That would make sense. There's this weird pattern of the actress from the previous film doing a voice in the second film, because in this, Jamie Lee Curtis is the...
She's the voice,
narrator,
yeah.
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 And then Adrienne Barbeau is the computer in The Thing. This is for a second film, this is very ambitious.
Right. It's striking how much they were able to pull off with such a tiny budget.
Yes. That's one of the first things I noticed at this rewatch. I guess we should say we've both probably watched this movie, I don't know how many times.
I haven't seen this movie too many times.
Oh, okay.
I've only seen this movie maybe 10 times.
Yeah, you're right. It's more like a 10 than a 50.
Right. It's not like The Thing.
Yeah, this movie is a lot, I guess, darker and a little slower. It's a little more and then. Like, it's sort of a series of things that happens.
Yes.
So I do feel less compelled to watch it.
It looks great, though.
It looks fantastic.
I love the look of Escape from New York. And I love the universe he sort of creates with it.
Yes.
It's very grimy and gritty. And I love Snake as a main character, because he's in the hero role, but he's not a hero.
I was about to say, I love Snake. I would never want to hang out with Snake.
No, like, he's emphatically not the hero. Like, there's
a
scene.
He's also not cool. Like,
not really. Like,
that
his
tattoo is dumb.
Yeah, his belly tattoo of a cobra is real dumb.
He's just this dumb guy. He's just a real dumb guy who doesn't talk.
Right, he's
much.
Just some asshole.
Yeah.
But, like, in terms of movie conventions, he is 100% the cool guy hero.
Yeah.
Like, he's got an eye patch. He's grizzled. Like, he, you know, he carries himself like Kurt Russell. So he's, like, very clearly like an action movie trope, but he doesn't behave that way.
No. Well,
which has always fascinated me about Snake Plissken.
He kind of, it's funny because I know what you're saying. Like, for example, he casually ignores a rape in this.
He does, yeah.
And he's not a hero.
Because he's not here for that, yeah.
But what I think is so funny about, or not, I guess funny, no, that's sort of the right word in terms of his character overall, mm-hmm. is it's that whenever you have the gruff anti-hero in other movies,
yeah,
they're not. Because
right,
they're
always they're always clearly the hero.
Yeah, they always like are like, oh, here we go again, and they like save people.
Right, they'll,
and
right,
this snake
they'll
is
be
like, no, I'm not going to save anyone for reals.
Like in other movies, the anti-hero will be just clearly the hero, except they're like an alcoholic or something.
Right,
like they have some sort of character flaw, but otherwise they still behave like a hero. Snake Plissken doesn't do anything for anyone but himself.
You could argue he's one of the villains of the movie.
We were talking about it while we were watching it, but if you were to classify Snake Plissken's alignment, he would be neutral evil.
Yeah. Yeah. Spoilers for Escape from New York. At the end, Snake casually eliminates like renewable energy for the world, like the hope for clean energy. The whole movie, the MacGuffin is this cassette tape.
This tape that the president has. Yeah.
That's almost more important than the president.
Yes.
And so they need it back. And at the end, he swaps the tapes because the president was rude.
President's a dick.
The president's a dick.
Like,
so
this
he,
is.
He basically dooms the world to climate change because the president was mean to him.
Yeah, possibly. And then we see it's almost certainly because we see in Escape from LA that climate change has definitely happened.
Oh, yeah. Very excited for that.
This movie is like the clearest representation of the politics of John Carpenter and Kurt Russell. Like, we talked about this on Cracked Movie Club.
Yeah. It's like real libertarian vibes.
They're both very libertarian.
Yeah.
And Snake is very much just fuck authority. Like, he, no matter if it's good or bad, he just bucks authority no matter what.
Which is funny because it feels like they're mocking libertarians in this because he, again,
a little bit.
He's not the hero. They show
no, he's not at
him doing
all.
Bad things.
Like, I think this movie.
He also, by
I
the
don't
way.
Wanna, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say Snake has been arrested. Because he robbed the Federal Reserve. I always forget that about him. Like in Die Hard 3, there's a cut scene where he does it. He's just a robber.
Yeah, he's been sentenced to life in prison for trying to rob the Federal Reserve.
He's just like doing a heist. What the fuck, Snake?
Yep. He's just trying to boost some money. That's all he cares about. At the risk of giving John Carpenter too much credit, I think this movie is pretty fair about the libertarian aspect, because you're right, it does pretty plainly show that Snake is not a hero and he doesn't help anyone unless it serves his interests.
Yeah, and here's the thing, I give John Carpenter all the credit, he's great, but also his films never feel political.
Like, this
feels a little political because it's, you know, the president and stuff.
Well,
there was also I read a behind the scenes thing that apparently Kurt Russell refused to flick his cigarette at Donald Pleasance at the end because he thought that wasn't cool to like do that to a president.
Sure.
It's like, well, it's not a real president, Kurt.
Sure, Kurt.
Yeah.
I mean, that was 19. It was a different time.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. It was a different time.
Yeah. I was going to say this movie feels extremely political for me, if for no other reason than for the first, I don't know, 10, 20 minutes when Snake is in New York, most of the prisoners are running from him.
Right.
Like,
they
the
all
movie,
know him, too, for some reason.
Yeah, everybody knows him, and they all think he's dead.
He's fucking famous.
The movie makes it pretty clear that most of these, the vast majority of these people in the prison colony do not belong there.
Yeah, you're right.
Like, they're not violent. They're like,
a lot of them are just trying to get by. They
right. People are just trying to get by. Exactly. So like, that's like the biggest piece of commentary, I think, from this movie, especially from a libertarian standpoint, is John Carpenter doesn't believe in prisons, or at least not in mass incarceration that we have right now.
Right. And I feel like we can all kind of get behind that at this point.
Oh, hell yeah, yeah.
I feel like the longer time goes, the more people are like, you know what? I think prisons are bullshit.
Yeah.
That's definitely a part of this. which again is funny because he's right. And this movie is definitely about that.
Mm-hmm.
Snake belongs in prison though. or some sort of, I mean, he's robbing the Federal Reserve.
Yeah.
Something needs to be done about Snake.
Well, Snake, I don't know. He's a fascinating character to me. Like I said, it's so interesting to put him in the hero role, and he is so clearly not the hero.
Yeah, I think there's a level of that which I enjoy because there's like a, it feels like there's more of a reality to that, I guess. Like it's the idea, we've talked about this, I'm sure Cracked is, I'm sure a lot of people have, that a character like John McClane would have to be a sociopath. Like they would, in order to be Kraken wise,
yeah,
for decades, doing what they do, there would have to be something wrong with them, because it's human to be affected and traumatized by things. And so Snake is sort of this expendable guy that the politicians throw, to the point that at the end, Donald Pleasance uses him as fucking bait to kill Isaac Hayes. And so he's just like the definition of expendable in this, and he can get the job done. And because he can get the job done, it means that he has to ignore a rape. He has to look the other way on a lot of stuff and just like focus. Like he has to be a bad person. They have to inject him with a brain exploding thing or whatever. Was it a virus? What did they do to him?
They inject him with two capsules that will, they're explosives the size of a pinhead.
Basically
they'll blast his arteries apart and he'll die.
Yeah. Snake's got to stop letting people, inject him with stuff. I'm pretty sure Skip from L.A., he has a similar problem.
Right.
Yeah. It is a weird thing to, because Carpenter's definitely saying, like, yeah, prisons are bullshit.
Carpenter's saying a lot. Carpenter's saying prisons are bullshit. Carpenter is saying that heroes are bullshit.
Yeah.
Carpenter is saying that governments exist to take care of the people, but they don't care about the people.
Right.
This
is all true.
This movie is saying a lot.
Yeah, I guess what's weird is the wondering, like, okay, so what? And I guess this is a question for libertarians that I'm never going to ask them to their face. But it's like, what's the fucking solution then?
I don't know.
Because that's the thing, is that it's like, yeah.
Right, that's the thing. This movie doesn't offer any solutions.
It doesn't offer solutions.
And that's not necessarily...
It's just a cynical, like, everything sucks.
Right, and that's not necessarily... It's not necessarily the job of satire to offer solutions.
No.
That's
true. I mean, I like this movie very clearly.
Yeah, I love this movie.
I think
and
that's
it very
why
clearly pokes holes in a lot of systemic things.
Yeah, I think that's why I don't think of it as political, because you're right. Everything you're saying is political.
Mm-hmm.
To me, it was just more just an overall, because I never thought of like, and I guess it is, but saying like, yeah, fucking prisons, we live in like a nightmare prison state situation. That never felt like that political. It's like, yeah, prisons are garbage.
This movie is extremely political. It's the most political movie John Carpenter has ever made.
And maybe it's the lack of trying to a solution or something. It's all feels like chaos.
Yeah.
Like I don't.
And then like the movie
like, I don't
itself
take the,
is
the client the fucking and renewable energy solution.
Mm-hmm.
Like what? What do you think was the decision there? I was actually thinking of the movie Snowpiercer, because the movie Snowpiercer basically ends with the hero deciding, fuck it. Like, if this is the society that has to exist, I'm going to literally derail everything.
I think that's somewhat of the mentality, because the conversation he has with the president right before he goes on the air does reveal that he doesn't care.
He doesn't care.
He doesn't care about the people.
And it means that he
so it's like, are
didn't
we just,
learn anything. He didn't learn.
Right. He didn't learn anything from the experience. So it's like, okay, so are we just is society just existing to perpetuate itself and not take care of its citizens? Right.
And like, oh, they get this climate change solving clean energy.
But doesn't do anything for the people. Yeah. Doesn't do anything for the people in New York.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
And then the movie.
It's funny like, because all that. Oh, sorry.
What I was going to say is New York in this movie is also somewhat of an indictment of libertarianism because New York in this movie is the absence of government.
You're right.
And it sort of becomes very tribalistic and violent and kind of it's you know,
they got a theater district.
They do have, yeah, they have a theater district, yeah. And fucking Ernest Borgnine is running a cab company somehow.
Well, they say the cars are steam powered, but I didn't see any evidence of that.
No, there's no coal going into those cars. Yeah. I think this movie, like I said at the beginning, this movie I think is pretty fair about it because it's kind of South Parkian in the sense that it's saying both sides are stupid and bullshit.
Yeah, it doesn't make me think he's a libertarian as much because you pointing this out is like, it does seem like he's saying, yeah, it can't be both. It can't be either way. It has to be somewhere in between.
Right.
But again, it's not offering a solution. It's more just like,
no.
Doesn't it suck that it can't be?
Right. It's just pointing out how much both libertarianism and traditional capitalist government sucks.
Yeah.
And yeah, you're right. It doesn't offer any solutions.
It's very
our
funny.
Our hero
the
is
more
a
I
real
about,
shithead.
Yeah, the more I think about now the movie Snowpiercer, which is not the same movie at all, but the message is very similar. The
message is very similar, yeah.
Where it's like, we don't have many options.
Yeah.
Like... They're, like, you know, Ed Harris at the end of that is like, we had to keep the people on the train surviving, so we needed a very specific system. And it's like, we have to keep the train running. So, yeah, we're going to put children in the engine.
Why not?
Because what else are we going to do? To which I say, can't you manufacture more parts? But whatever. Yeah, it's kind of the same thing where it's like, we're just fucked. Like, we shouldn't continue on is basically what Snake at the end has decided.
Yeah.
It's like, no, let's let us burn ourselves out.
Yeah, and that's kind of Snake's arc. It's like Snake, like we've pointed out a few times, Snake in the very beginning pointedly does not intervene in a rape. But he comes to try and defend this group of survivors that he's got.
Mm-hmm.
With Brain and Cabby and Maggie, and they all die, and he's pretty upset about it, and that's what ultimately makes him decide to swap the tape and destroy the real tape, is that he asked the president, like, that's all he asked the president is, how do you feel about this? Like, a couple of people died to save you, how do you feel about that? And the president gives, like, a very, doesn't even look at him.
I don't want to defend...
gives a very... non-committal answer. So Snake's like, all right.
Yeah. I don't want to defend the president, but he's probably traumatized.
Yes.
I was reading behind the scenes, Donald Pleasance actually was a prisoner of a war, and he based a lot of the character and made suggestions based off his own experiences with that.
Okay.
Which is interesting, because the ending, when he shoots Isaac Hayes, and he's like, yeah, the king! Or whatever he says.
A number one, Duke
A number
New York.
One. That was very much inspired, I guess, by him as a prisoner of war, which makes me wonder what the fuck happened. But yeah, I sort of like having read that before watching this, that last scene, obviously it's supposed to be interpreted, like obviously it's, he doesn't care. That's the point.
Yeah,
but I was thinking like, oh, maybe he's just traumatized. Like, the meta thoughts was like, oh, maybe he's just like, because people react to trauma in different ways, he's just sort of trying to continue with his life. Obviously, we're in a world where there's New York's a prison. Like, it's still a world that's, in Snake's eyes, not worth saving.
Yes.
But the character itself is the president. I was I don't know. I was thinking more about it. I mean, when he goes to the prison, they have on the loudspeaker, you now have the option to be terminated and cremated on the premises.
Yes.
Which means that people can choose to be killed instead of going to the prison?
Yes.
Huh.
It's real dystopian.
Yeah, it's real dystopian.
And it's a real commentary on the prison system.
Yeah. I do want a pillow that has that embroidered on it. You now have the option to be terminated and cremated on the premises.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. No, I want that to hang above my bed every night when I go to sleep.
Yeah.
It's a very comforting thought.
It's such a weird, and maybe this is why, because this movie is a classic. And I think what's interesting about John Carpenter movies is they're all like, how do I put this? He's such a good director, and it's so well made, but you could see a version where this was a bad movie. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Like, a lot of bad movies have plots like this. Like, the character of Snake
is a
dumb guy.
Right, he's a dumb... But Carpenter makes his movies about things.
Yeah, and he's also very good.
He's very good, yeah. So
yeah, you're right. They're like, also about things. You're right. That's
right,
part
I
of
think
it.
The thing that saved this movie from being just another one in the heap of the interminable number of films that had a similar premise in the 80s is obviously, one, his direction. Like, his direction is very... unique and interesting,
right?
But he was saying something with this movie.
I guess what I was getting to is that this movie has always stood out. It's a classic, but I don't think people watch it that often.
I don't think so either.
Yeah, I don't. People like the way you watch your favorite movies and stuff. People don't like relax with this movie. I'm sure some people do because. Yeah, there's a lot of people in the world.
This was my older cousin's favorite movie.
Right.
Growing up, and he's about, gosh, he's probably 10 years older than my brother. So he showed this to us when we were kids, and it felt slow as a kid.
Yeah, it's kind of slow.
And then watching it as an adult, I'm like, my God, this movie is a masterpiece.
Yeah. But I guess it's more that the movie's not very fun to watch.
It's not a fun watch.
The characters are very serious.
Right. Kurt Russell's a dope, but he's very severe.
Yeah.
And the movie's very severe. And I'm positive that is on purpose. Because John Carpenter knows how to make a hero. Like, there are heroes in other John Carpenter movies. Like, Roddy Piper in They Live is a hero.
Right.
MacReady in The Thing is a hero. Pliskin in this movie is such a challenging character. He's, like, weirdly challenging.
Yeah. Carpenter really fought for Kurt Russell, too.
Go ahead. What's that?
Oh, I was going to say, Carpenter... really fought for Kurt Russell.
The studio
wanted either Tommy Lee Jones or Chuck Norris.
Holy fucking shit. Can you imagine Tommy Lee Jones in this movie?
Yeah, it was before Tommy Lee Jones was famous. Like, it's pre-Fugitive, a lot of it.
This is 81.
Yeah, this is young Tommy Lee Jones.
It's a year after The Fog and a year before The Thing.
Yeah. I could honestly see Tommy Lee Jones pulling it off. Chuck Norris, I'm glad they didn't, because I think that what was happening is the studio was like, maybe we can get more of an action film out of this, you know? Like, maybe
they wanted a star.
Yes, and well, Kurt Russell was known at the time, but I think there must have...
But as a child star.
Yeah, you're right. There must have been some connection between Carpenter and Kurt Russell before this movie, where they knew they were on the same page. Like, because Carpenter was just like, from the start, was like, I want Kurt Russell. Mm-hmm. And then at the end of the day, he got his first choice.
Yeah.
But it does seem like a collaboration between the two.
Oh, yeah. I think they both collaborated on the character.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I think the eye patch was Kurt Russell's idea.
Eye patch is a good idea?
Yeah. He said something like I saw an interview where he was like, there hasn't been a hero with an eye patch since True Grit. And True Grit is a very interesting reference.
Also... very similar, because Rooster Cogburn is in the hero role, but he's not necessarily a hero.
Exactly. They knew they knew exactly what Snake, they wanted Snake to be.
Yes. They wanted Snake to be this very ambiguous shades of gray character.
Yeah.
He's probably the only true anti-hero I can think of. Because
yes.
To be honest, like seriously, like every other anti-hero you can come up with, I guarantee they just play the point, the part of the hero to a T, except right. they have some character flaw.
Yes. In terms of,
but Snake is the only design. One that's actually challenging in the things that he does.
Yes. In terms of characters that were absolutely designed to be anti-heroes, yes. Because I was thinking of like...
like Jason, Tony Soprano.
I was thinking of Jason Voorhees.
Oh, well.
He's my favorite anti-hero.
Oh, he's the best.
Because I'm rooting for him the whole time.
That was a it was fun listening to the How Did This Get Made of like Friday the 13th Part 6 when Jason Mantzoukas realizes, oh, Jason is the hero.
Yeah.
Jason's the main character.
Yeah.
It's like, yes, no, we're watching these movies for Jason, yeah. not for these other people.
But yeah, you're right, is that this is, man, it's yeah. This is the ultimate anti-hero movie.
I'm sure
there's some along the way, but this is...
Outside of, like, maybe Vic Mackey in The Shield.
I never watched The Shield.
I mean, he's... they start the series... In the very first episode, he murders another police officer to save his own ass.
Oh, wow.
So they start the show off with, like, this guy is bad.
Yeah. Well, it's hard because of the definition of an anti-hero. Because you brought up Tony Soprano... But I never, it's so tough because I don't think of him as even a hero or in
right.
a heroic
he's just
role.
Sort of a, he's just sort he's of, just, he's like the shark in Jaws. Like he just kind of does what he does and you're like, well, that's what it's going to do.
It's not like an action, like The Sopranos is an action. It's a drama. So like,
yeah,
I was thinking like adventure action, like keeping it to that genre of anti-heroes, because I guess the one that keeps sticking out is Batman, and Batman is like always seems like yeah he's the false anti-hero. He's always like
he's
gonna kill
Batman's
you.
Not
and it's
an
like you're never gonna kill anybody.
Batman is not an anti-hero. Batman is a hero.
Yeah, he's a hero, but he has the like they always made him seem like
they
he's
try to
dangerous.
Tell us that he's like super dark.
Yeah, he goes to beat up the Joker and he locks the door and everybody's like, oh no, he's gonna kill him in there, and it's like he's never gonna kill him in there.
Yeah,
he's Batman.
Like yeah
he only Batman, kills people and doesn't realize it later,
right? Like Batman has a lot of pathos, but Batman is not an anti-hero.
Yeah.
Like, Snake Plissken is an anti-hero.
Yeah.
Like, he does things that are not heroic.
Yeah. Like surfing on a tidal wave. We'll get yep. to that.
Oh, that yeah, that's an Escape from LA.
Yeah. So excited to talk about that movie.
It's such a he's such an interesting character. Like like I said, this might be the only movie that actually pulls off an anti-hero yeah. because he does
well,
a
so
lot of
things
that you can't like. And like the end of the movie, even though you're like, well, fuck the president, but he's also kind of doomed the planet.
Yeah.
When he dismantles that tape. So it's like,
it's
well, fuck this guy.
It's everything all the way down to, again, that stupid tattoo. I think he looks dumb. I think he talks dumb. Like everything about him is like a guy who's trying to be cool. And I
right,
love
he's
him
like a stereotype of a cool guy.
Yeah. But he's ridiculous. He's a ridiculous person. He's always making the same like weird face. He's got that face like you ever see videos of like cats smelling something that's weird and they make that funny face?
Yes.
Like that's what Snake's permanent face is.
Yeah, he looks like he's constantly smelling a fart.
Yeah. He's got this weird wince.
Fart
he's
face.
Like,
yeah.
You could never have a conversation
fart
with
fart face Plissken.
Yeah, yeah. You'd never want to talk to this guy. They do such a good job with, and I don't even know if they meant to do this because I heard this was a rewrite, but when they introduced that woman at the Chock Full of Nuts.
Yeah, that was his wife at the time.
It was, right. And Adrienne Barbeau was Carpenter's wife at the time.
Yeah, they were married for a few years.
So they just killed off their wives in this, which, all right.
Yeah, Adrienne Barbeau is kind of a bummer in this movie, because they don't give her much of a character, and she had such a huge character in The Fog previously. So it's kind of a bummer in this movie that she's just Brain's muscle and doesn't really get to do anything.
Yeah.
And kind of dies like an idiot.
Yeah. Doesn't Brain kind of die? He crashes.
No, Brain steps on a landmine.
Oh, shit.
through the minefield that he was supposedly memorizing.
Oh, so Brain dies also like an asshole.
Brain also dies like an idiot.
Shit, what was it? Oh, yeah, but they introduce that woman, and she's like, I hear you're getting someone out of here. You want to bring me out of here? And they, like, they make him like, I'm not, like, not interested in this. And she's, like, all over him, and you're, like, you know, first time viewing, you're like, okay, well, here's the romance. And then she gets sucked into the floor, and we never see her again.
Yep.
And that's such a
It's the one nakedly heroic thing that Snake does.
Yes.
There's a gang that basically explodes into this chock full of nuts restaurant like zombies, and they pull her through the floor like Bill Paxton in Aliens, and he tries to save her.
He does, but
he tries.
Also, he tries to save her in the sense that like she's right in front of him. It costs nothing to try to save her, but then he gets over it fast. But I liked because we're talking about how he's a true anti-hero. Is mm-hmm. that you could almost see the relationship where it's like he warms up to her slowly and they get together and it's like an Indiana Jones type situation. And then the movie just cancels that completely. Well, and I love that because it's like,
it's a real subversion. That scene is real subversive.
It is. And it plays into the anti-hero shit where it's like, not only is that going to happen, but Snake isn't going to care later. He's not even going to think about it.
No, he's
going
to forget. Like, he'll try to save her right then, but he's not going to carry that loss with him.
What?
He's like, well, I didn't even know her name.
Why does he want to be called Plissken at the end?
I think...
Because
we talked about this on the movie club, and I probably should have listened to that episode before we did this. Although I don't even know if those episodes still exist. Because in the beginning, he's like, "Call me Snake," when they're calling him Plissken, and then at the end, Lee Van Cleef calls him Snake, and he's like, "Call me Plissken."
Here's my theory: he has an erection at the beginning, and throughout
this
the movie.
This is a ridiculous theory. Okay, got it.
And throughout the movie...
This is not an actual theory. Okay, go ahead.
He slowly loses it.
Right, he slowly becomes disengorged. Got it.
Yes, and he's like, call me Snake because, you know, because he's excited. And then by the end, he's like, it's just Plissken now.
I think what it actually means, instead of whatever the hell you just said...
He's got a little Plissken in his pants.
Yeah, I think what it actually means is, in the beginning, he sort of... being anti-authority by being like, no, don't call me Snake. Call me by my nickname, you know, to the government.
Yeah.
And then at the end, after he's done their fucking secret bullshit and they really screwed him over and a bunch of people he started to care about got killed and they're trying to be familiar with him by calling him Snake. He's like, no. You may call me Plissken.
Yeah, that's the impression I got too, actually.
Yeah.
Cuz it's that guy,
it's Lee Van Cleef.
Yeah, and he's almost like who was injured while they were filming this, by the way.
Yes.
He's talked about how like some of the hardest shots of his career in this movie, just having to walk. Yeah, there's this, like, because he also says, like, I'll kill you for this at the beginning. And he's like, you're going to kill me?
Right,
he's,
he
like,
says, when
tired.
I see you again, I'm going to kill you.
Yeah, and at the end, he's, like, too tired. And it does feel like Plissken almost, like, he just loses his, like, steam. Like, he loses, like, he just ends up being just bummed out more than angry.
He's beaten down.
Yeah, and so, like,
by the whole... machine of the government.
Yeah, and the snake is like the fighting version of himself too, where mm-hmm. Plissken is just like, eh, that's actually, it's probably actually his last name. I'm guessing Snake isn't his first name.
No, they do say his name is S.D. Plissken. So
okay.
His name is almost certainly not Snake. But...
it would be amazing. Like a scene in the hospital and the mother looks at him and she's like, he's beautiful. I'm going to name him Snake.
It's probably like Sam or something. But like, yeah. It's, I think it's just, he's, I think the message is that he's not been cowed, but he's like, he says, I'm too tired. Like, he's literally beaten down by the system. And he's just like, I can't even fight you guys right now. I'm so exhausted by this. Yeah. And I know that's a feeling that a lot of us relate to right now.
Yeah. It's, this movie is, fucking,
this movie is extremely political.
The fact that we're asking these questions, being like, what do you think this means? Means that this movie is great.
Yeah.
It is a fucking terrific movie.
It really is.
Can we
talk about Romero?
Yes.
That prince. Can we talk about
that? Yes. We haven't even talked about Romero.
I forget his name. We looked up the actor when we covered this on Cracked Movie Club because he's so fucking incredible in this movie.
When he's the one who finds the tape, right?
Yeah, he's the one that comes and meets Lee Van Cleef and says, if you touch me, you're dead. And
but
yeah, and he does
finds
a bunch
the tape
of
in the briefcase.
Yes.
He holds it up to his ear. Did you notice that?
Yes. Oh yeah.
Okay.
He does a lot of really fun stuff.
Yeah.
in this role. Like when they're walking away from
he does the point.
When he does the point when they're walking away from Brain. Like that's
so
incredible.
Fucking good.
He's so good.
I wonder, I'm sure it's a lot of John Carpenter working with the actors to be like, look, you're in this movie, you get to do a thing. What is your thing you want it to be? And like, it seemed like a lot of collaboration. I know, again, with Donald Pleasance, the wig scene where he has the blonde wig, that was Donald Pleasance's idea. It feels like it's a lot of Carpenter working with actors and being like, you see what I'm going for, right? So go nuts. Just tell me what you want to do. And that fucking hero who played Romero.
Right, like that's clearly a role where Carpenter was like, look, just be weird.
Yeah.
And that guy dunked it as far as being weird. Yeah. It was a tomahawk dunk of weirdness.
He was so fucking good.
He's so great.
He looks like a vampire. Like, he doesn't look human.
He gets stabbed. When he gets stabbed, he's like,
he's so sad.
The noise that comes out of him when
he
gets stabbed.
I feel like after that take, John Carpenter would be like, what the fuck was that? And he's like, do you want me to do it again? And he's like, no, not at all.
Beautiful. That's perfect. An all-time cinema history moment. Don't do it again. We captured it on video forever.
Yeah. It's like filming a car crash. It's like, no two takes.
It's like filming the moon landing.
Yeah.
we're not doing this again.
Yeah.
That guy's incredible.
He isn't. I'm sure we looked him up.
We did. We looked him up. I remember we found out his name.
We did a whole other podcast about this movie for people wondering.
Yeah, we did. Yeah, we did. Cracked Movie Club back before we all got fired.
Yeah, I actually made a note not to listen to it or check the notes because I didn't want to just use what was in there.
Yeah, yeah. That's fair.
I do want to talk about St. Louis though because it's my It's my favorite. Making of detail, which is that they couldn't shoot in New York because it's too expensive.
It's way too expensive.
So they're like, we need a place that looks like New York, but like in ruins. And they were like, St. Louis, how's it going? St. Louis was like, please film here. And he talks about how like the New York Grand Central Station, when they filmed there, it was in St. Louis, but it was a building, and he said when we walked in, he said, oh, we don't even have to dress it. Like, it's just in shambles wherever they were filming.
Nice.
And they filmed the plane crash there by, I believe, trucking in a plane at 2 a.m, filming the scene, and then trucking the parts out, having not asked anybody if they could do that.
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of shots in this movie where I'm like, I bet that shot was stolen.
Yeah. Although they did get permission for Liberty Island. And I you can see in the movie, they shoot it all from below above, like shooting up.
It's a low angle, yeah.
Because they were the first film company allowed on Liberty Island, according to John Carpenter. And you can tell
that might be true.
What's that?
I said that might be true.
It might be true. They had like a couple days, 2 days to shoot it. And yeah, you can tell they couldn't dress it or anything. They just like shot the shots with the Statue of Liberty.
Yeah, they did a lot of low angle shots of the Statue of Liberty and then had like all the post-apocalyptic stuff in the foreground.
Yeah.
So it's like, okay, you couldn't build next to the Statue of Liberty.
Yeah, which of course they couldn't.
No. Also, this movie, I remember in the making of, John Carpenter pointed out there's a lot of extended shots in this film.
Yeah.
And people may take that as being artistic, but it was really because he just wanted to save money.
Yeah, there's a lot of that.
Because if you do extended takes, that means less setups. That
right.
means and less
you,
money.
You cover the scene so, quicker. You just, yeah.
yeah.
God, there's a bunch of really cool little details. The fact that James Cameron worked on this movie before
he was
James Cameron.
He did. He worked on the effects.
Yeah, there's a fairly known picture of him painting the, what's it called?
Like the glider,
the matte painting. No, the matte painting for the day shot of New York.
Right.
When they're all in the field in Central Park.
Yes.
He worked on a lot of things, yeah.
He worked on the effects on this movie.
Yeah. The other scene that, of course, is like pretty iconic is, of course, Kurt Russell versus the old-timey wrestler-looking dude.
Right, versus Karnov.
Yeah.
In the fucking ring.
Played by Ox Baker. I looked him up.
Sure.
He didn't know how to pull punches, apparently, according to Kurt Russell. So Kurt Russell got hurt a lot doing it. And I think we talked about this on Movie Club. It's the craziest thing is that the part where he hits him in the back of the head with the spiked baseball bat, they just had like a thing on the back of his head and told Kurt Russell to stab into it. And the wrestler was very nervous.
Obviously.
Had Kurt Russell missed, he would have just brained him.
Yeah, he would have killed him.
Yeah. So that's pretty funny. That's some good indie bullshit.
Yeah, so that's this movie.
Yeah. That's some real, like, Sam Raimi level putting actors in danger.
Yeah, this movie is steeped in darkness.
Yeah, I like to think that was the wrestler's last shot. Like, they shot everything else first. And they were like,
They did.
Yeah. Just, you know, just in case.
Oh,
what
man.
A film. It really looks like, for the budget... What was the budget?
I don't know. It was extremely low budget.
It looks so good for the budget.
It looks excellent.
Yeah. They did such a good job. Because I think a lot of it, since it's shot at night, they got away with a lot.
Yeah.
A lot of the models
The budget
and stuff.
Was $6 million.
Wow.
Which is more than I would have thought.
Yeah. So he went from Halloween to this. That's so ambitious.
Halloween to Fog to this.
Okay. So the Fog was next. That makes more sense because it's like horror movie with a little more of a budget, and then they let him do this.
They gave him a little bit more money, and this movie is so conceptually awesome, and he pulls it off on that micro budget so well that this is a good movie.
This is a great movie. With a sequel that I can't wait to talk about.
Oh my gosh, the sequel.
I'm going to say this is... Obviously, we'll talk about it more in the next episode, but I'm going to suspect that Escape from LA is the more fun watch. Not the better film. The more fun watch, because it's going to be so bad.
It's definitely more ludicrous.
Yeah.
That's for sure.
There's
none of the commentary that this movie has.
No. Again, we're going to talk about it more. I haven't looked at the behind the scenes of Escape from LA. My guess is that John Carpenter was influenced into making the sequel.
Maybe.
It'd be so weird if it was his idea. Because of what you said, it's not political. It's not dark. It feels like for the sequel, John Carpenter was like, let's just have fun.
Right, yeah. And he really splurged on visual effects in Escape from LA.
And it's like, there's no legacy here. You know, the first one stands on its own. It can't be ruined by a sequel.
Right.
The character Snake, you can pretend you never see him again after the first one. And I feel like they knew all that, so they were like, let's just go nuts. And Kurt Russell was like, can I have a basketball scene? And he's like, of course you can have a basketball scene.
Well, obviously. Why wouldn't you have a basketball scene?
You're Snake fucking Plissken. You rule at basketball, apparently. Oh, I can't wait.
We're going to talk about this. Yeah, I can't wait to talk about Escape from LA. Oh, my gosh.
Oh, man. But this movie. You have any other thoughts on this movie?
No, that's pretty much my thoughts on Escape from New York.
It's a very good movie. Yeah. Very good movie.
You might not realize that it's about so many things because not a single other one of John Carpenter's films are about anything necessarily.
Hold on. Because after The Thing, didn't he do They Live?
He did. They Live is another...
Is very political.
They Live is very political. Even The Thing is kind of political.
Yeah, because it's about the Red Scare.
It's about the Cold War.
So yeah, his movies do get political. That's the thing. I think maybe They Live is his most political movie. And then this.
It might be his most overtly political film.
Yeah.
But I think this one is the one that has the most to say.
Yeah, I could see that.
Because like They Live is pretty much just, you know, capitalism is bullshit.
Yeah.
But this one is more nuanced.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, that's fair.
In They Live, he puts on sunglasses and they're all literal monsters.
Yeah.
It
feels more like something more personal to what John Carpenter had to say. It's like an earlier film, so he probably had more. Yeah. And then They Live, he was like, I want to do something about fucking commercialism.
Right.
It's fine.
Like, this one feels more important to him.
Yeah.
And to Kurt Russell.
Yeah. I wish they'd work together again.
Yeah.
What's the last film they did? Was it Escape from L.A.?
It was Escape from L.A., yeah.
Man. Get back together,
guys.
Do
another thing. Fuck it. Who gives a shit?
Yeah, if anything, he should go on one of John Carpenter's, like, crazy music tours. Just drive around in a van.
Yeah, and just, like, slap a tambourine or something. Who gives a fuck?
Yeah, who gives a fuck? What do you think? Kurt Russell, he might be a harmonica guy. I can see him having that, like, Bruce Willis
harmonica
energy. Oh, I can
see Kurt Russell wailing on a harmonica. Yes, yeah, absolutely.
Something like that. I guess that's it.
Yeah, that's all. I'm done.
Okay.
That does it for this episode of Duology Theater.
Yeah. Thank you guys for listening. If you're interested, you should go to our Patreon at patreon.com/gamefullyunemployed. We have a tier where you can make us watch specific movies. You can produce your own podcast, which is what this is. And we got exclusive podcasts like Tom and Jeff Watch Batman and Fox Mulder is a Maniac. So check that out.
Look into that. We also have a store, tpublic.com/store/gamefullyunemployed. But please don't buy a t-shirt right now. Just take care of yourself.
Yeah. Unless you're stupid rich.
I mean, if you're disgustingly rich, then buy multiple t-shirts. Please
buy all of the t-shirts. Yeah. Yeah.
Just make it rain on us.
Yeah. And also, like, donate and stuff to, like, hospitals and junk.
Uh-huh.
But mostly the t-shirts.
Before you do that, buy the t-shirts, yes.
Duology Theater is brought to you by Gamefully Unemployed. Check out our cool shit at patreon.com/gamefullyunemployed.